Welcome to CBI. Thank you for coming today. Our speaker today is Professor Anu Malani, who is speaking on valuing laws as local amenities. We'll have one more CBI this quarter, which will be Professor Henderson on May 9th. So go ahead and mark that on the calendar. Thanks for coming.
Great. Thanks very much for coming to this talk. I think this is typically burdensome for me because I've got to prepare a plan, but after talking to one of the students, I actually find that this is much more complex than you. I think there are a lot of students here that are just in my health law class, and some of them said that they had to actually go to classes this afternoon, too. So I think you guys are going to bear most of the burden today, so hopefully it'll be even, at least at the end, by giving some useful information. Okay, so before I jump into this talk is basically about a proposal for how we should judge laws. Not judge cases, but judge laws. Let me kind of walk you through why I think this is an interesting question. So when you come to law school, a lot of you come saying, oh, I want to learn about what the law is because I want to become a lawyer at the end. And some of you might come also, well, I want to think about the law and how good or bad it is. But both of you, both types of students, when they get to class, do both things. They learn a little bit about the law, and then after we discuss a law or a case, you know, a typical question you get from a teacher is, so is this a good rule? Do you think this person should have won? How do you feel? Right? These sorts of things, which are meant to elicit your views on whether or not normatively this law was a good idea or a bad idea. Okay? Now, typically, and I would say 9 times out of 10, and I don't think I did wrong, you're doing so based upon just your preferences, your prior beliefs, or your immense experience in 22 years of life. And not because you've done an extensive empirical study or talked to a lot of people and surveyed people that have been affected by this law and seen what they do. Now, some of you, I'm not going to try to diminish any of that or diminish too much of that. Some of you have actually done practice beforehand and have had personal experience with one particular type of law. But we deal with a lot of different types of law just in your first year, and we're constantly asking you what you think about them to evaluate them normally. And so that's the sort of question that motivates me here. I'm not interested in what you think about a law. I'm trying to answer whether or not a law is a good idea or a bad idea. Is it promoting the welfare of citizens or residents of the country, or is it not? Okay? So, for example, some years back, I tried to write a paper on the effect of the felony murder rule, whether or not it was a good idea or a bad idea, and I looked at, for example, the effect of the felony. Does anybody know what the felony murder rule is? Everybody does, right? Everybody's done for great, fantastic. And my guess is that you probably do get a positive view of the felony murder rule. Most of the commentary is not very positive. But anyway, so you got the felony murder rule that jacks up your punishment during a felony if someone dies, even if you didn't intend to death. I'm being kind of crude about it, but roughly that's what it does. So I want to evaluate whether it was good or bad. And so I said, what's the thing I should do? Now, I could have gone to you guys and asked what you thought personally. But I want to try a different approach. I want to do an empirical study. So when I want to do an empirical study, I say, okay, so what sort of things should I look at to determine whether or not it's a good law or a bad law? Well, maybe I should look at what happens to the number of felonies. Right? Do felonies fall in states or jurisdictions that have the felony murder rule? Do they rise in jurisdictions that relax the rule? Right? Basically lower the punishment, implicit punishment for felony? What happens to the number of deaths during felonies? Are people more careful? People meaning people that are committing felonies. Are they more careful to avoid death during felonies? These are the sorts of empirical questions. I wanted to look at, in short, the effect of a criminal law on crime. The effect of a criminal law on toxic behavior. And that toxic behavior happened to be crime. Okay? And that actually, I think, is the orthodox view of how you evaluate empirically, right, with data, whether a law is good or bad. Okay? And in this paper, I'm going to try to give you an alternative. Okay. That's the whole purpose of the paper. I'm going to argue that there's an alternative way, perhaps better way, not perfect, but better way to evaluate whether or not a law is good. And there's the way that I'm going to propose is actually, I'm not going to claim all the credit for it, because it's an idea that's been around for a while, at least since maybe the late 60s, mid 70s, but not in the context that we're used to thinking about. Let me give you a context in which we might be used to thinking about this. And actually, let me take this off the screen because I think you'll just be distracted. Because I'm going to say that, but I want to get to that in a second. So the basic idea is something like this. So if we want to value a lake, right? Let's suppose we want to value Lake Michigan. How great is Lake Michigan? One way, obviously, again, is to go hand out surveys and say, hey, you guys think that Lake Michigan is good? Would you prefer it not be there? But that's not going to get you very far. An alternative approach that we use, we meaning actually environmental economists, will use is they'll say, okay, well, if people like a lake, in particular, they like being close to the lake, maybe they'll be willing to pay a little bit more to live close to that lake. Okay? So we might expect, for example, property that's right at the edge of the lake to be more expensive than property that's a half mile from the lake, or a mile from the lake, or 10 miles from the lake. And as we look at that kind of, we can actually just plot it out. I could just draw it on the board. I could say, you know, I'll need a marker in order to draw it on the board. I could say, okay, here's your distance from Lake Michigan. These guys live on Lake Michigan. These guys live, you know, 10 miles away. And this is the price that you're paying for living close to Lake Michigan. What I mean by the price is saying, if you take a two-bedroom house that looks identical in all respects, right? One that's 10 miles away and one that's 0 miles away, and we just see, okay, how does the price of that house change as we move closer to the lake? And we'd expect the price to look something like this, right? Price rises for that exact same piece of property, all the things being equal about the property, as that property gets closer to the lake. And we use that to basically decide how much the lake is worth. What is the lake worth? Sorry, I don't mean to bring up calculus in a law seminar, but I'm going to do it just a little bit. Basically, you take the area underneath this curve. That's the total value that people are paying at different places just to be close to the lake. Okay? We know that they must get that amount of value from being close to the lake because they're paying that extra amount just for being close to the lake. If they didn't get that value, they were being irrational. And we're at the University of Chicago. We do not believe in irrationality. Okay? So that's the basic insight that I'm going to use. This is an insight that was used to value environmental amenities. It's been used in environmental amenities for a long period of time. Okay. Roughly the mid-1970s. But it's been confined, basically, to environmental amenities. Occasionally, you'll see it being used to value, for example, a school. You know, for those of you that might grow up in Chicago, you might say, oh, I want to compare Nutrier to Evanston. Well, I can look at property values and see how much more people are willing to live in a jurisdiction where their kids get to go to Nutrier as opposed to Evanston Township High School. Okay? But you could have done that same sort of a comparison from whatever town or state you came from. My innovation here, my point here is there's nothing special about lakes, there's nothing special about schools, there's nothing special about laws. They're all the same thing. They're local amenities. And what do I mean by local amenities? I mean that you have to live in the jurisdiction, for the most part, you have to live in the jurisdiction to enjoy that law. And because you have to live in the jurisdiction to enjoy that law, if that law is a good law, you will pay more to live in that jurisdiction. And the extra amount that you're going to pay to live under a law tells me how valuable that law is. That's the point. So instead of looking at the effect of a crime, of a new criminal law on crime rates, we look at how that law affects housing prices. In fact, I'm going to be a little bit more complicated than that. I'm going to be a little bit more subtle than that. This idea wasn't just adopted or accepted in environmental economics in the 1970s. Labor economists worked on it and extended it a little bit. And I'm going to inherit some of their ideas as well, or I'm going to use some of their ideas. And so the intuition is something like this. Let's suppose you have state A, state B, Illinois, Michigan, or Illinois, Indiana, contiguous. And they're otherwise identical. I know they're not, right? Depends on what state you're from. You'll already have an opinion on which is better. But let's suppose they're otherwise identical. And then Illinois passes a law that people like, right? And depending on your political head, maybe it's a law that makes it easier to execute prisoners, maybe it's a law that abolishes the death penalty, whatever it happens to be, okay? You decide. The people that like that law that Illinois adopts, they move to Illinois. Or at least they want to live in Illinois because of that law, okay? Now what happens when a person moves from Michigan, from Indiana to Illinois to live under a particular law? Well, two things. If they want to live under the law and they want to live in Illinois, they'll probably need a house in Illinois, right? Because it's not really feasible to go live in, you know, Indianapolis and then work in, you know, live under, you know, working in Illinois, and maybe live in Illinois. So they need a house. And that's why we see housing prices rise. Right? In order to enjoy the amenities, to enjoy the law, you have to live under it. That means you have to have a house under it. So that's where we get the housing crisis. But the other thing that you need, it's not the only thing you need, but generally you still have something you need, you probably need a job. Right? Because you got to pay bills. And again, it's not going to make sense for you to have your job in Indianapolis, but have your house in Chicago. So you need a local job too. But when you get a local job, what you're doing is you're saying, I'm going to supply my labor to a local market. The local market here is in Illinois. And as more and more people supply their labor to a local market, it's going to have the opposite effect on the labor market than it does on the housing market. On the housing market, more and more people seeking houses in Illinois bids up prices of houses in Illinois. More and more people seeking jobs in Illinois actually bids down prices of labor, wages in Illinois. Okay? So, what you really want to think about is, okay, if I've got a good law, I expect it to do two things, or I expect it to do at least a combination of things. One is increase housing prices, and the second is lower wages. Those things don't cancel out, they add up. And here's the way to think about this. Should I, suppose I'm in Indiana, and there's a great law in Illinois, and I'm deciding whether to move. And I say, if I stay in Indiana, I don't get the law. Okay? But if I go to Illinois, I get the law. But I also get two other things. One bad thing that I get is I get a lower wage. And the other bad thing I get is that I have to pay more for housing. Right? Because it's a desirable law. So I have to weigh the benefit of the law versus these two costs which add on to each other. One, a higher housing price, and two, a lower wage. Okay? So that's the proper way to view this. And I will move to the state if the value of the law is greater than or equal to the cost that I bear. Right? If at some point I decide, no, the cost of housing and the loss in wage is bigger than the value of the law to me, I'm not going to do it. In fact, you can make use of the standard sort of equilibrium arguments that economists make all the time. You know, you probably have heard this, if not directly in the economics class, indirectly through your first year classes, right? This will happen until there's that last person that moves, holding everything else constant, by the way. The last person moves into Illinois, they're going to be exactly indifferent between the benefit of the law and the cost of the law. That is to say, increasing housing price and the loss in wage, you sum those two changes up, right? And whatever that is, I'm going to be indifferent between that and the law. The value of the law. And that's how we value the law. You rely on that equilibrium effect to value the law. So that's basically what I'm saying here. Right? That change in housing price plus the loss in wage, the increase in housing price plus the loss in wage is the cost of moving the law. You'll move as long as the law is worth more than that. You'll stop moving when the law is exactly equal to that. And guess what? That means that if we just look at before and after a law is passed, the change in housing prices and the change in wages, sum those two things up, we've got a decent measure of the value of the law. Okay? Now, we'll save this for the Q&A, but I'll tell you ahead of time, I will defend the argument that you don't actually have to have any movement. People don't actually have to cross borders for this effect to occur. And I'm going to depend, you know, that this method will work even as you're starting to build more houses or things like that. Okay, those are not going to be problems, but I'll save that a little later. Now, I want to be very honest here. I did mention this idea of looking at the effect of a law on proximate behavior to judge whether it's a good law or not. That's the standard, kind of the orthodox way that we judge laws. I mean, if you go to the law and economics seminar, it seems like half the papers are trying to do that, right? A lot of the professors on the faculty do that. I still do that sort of stuff. Miles does that sort of stuff. Lots of people. But there are other methods that you might use to judge a law. And I'd be happy to defend my method against any of these. They all have their relative advantages, but I don't think they're as good as the approach that I'm suggesting. So you might imagine some of these on your own. You could do the surveys. Are people happy with the law? You can look at, how much are people willing to pay to lobby for a law? Right? That's a measure. What is the effect of the law on the domestic product of a state or a jurisdiction? Or on stock prices. Or, kind of a subset of what I proposed, instead of looking at housing prices or wages, why don't we just see if people actually move? Right? These are all sort of indirect methods. I think you'll find that my method is a little bit better. So let me give you the advantages of my method over all those other methods you might think of. Okay? The one in red being the most popular one. Well, look, I'm going to use some technical language here that I just can't stop using because I was trained as an economist, but it's like a bad habit. Here it is, forgive me. If we care about the utility of a law, looking at housing prices and wages gets us a better estimate of utility in dollar terms than the other methods. And the reason is because the willingness to pay, when I'm making that judgment as a mover, right, as a potential resident, I'm comparing that to the utility, the happiness, whatever you want to call it, right? Depends on how you were trained. The I call it a utility, the utility of the law. So in that sense, it's a kind of a monetary translation from the utility of the law to the amount that I'm willing to pay. Right? Or the cost that I'm willing to bear to be more precise. And so in that sense, I'm getting a more direct proxy for utility. Now you might say, whoop-de-doo. Well, the economists care, and I still, you know, worry about what my peers think about me, so I care, I guess. But I think you should care too, because, you know, when you ask how good a law is, how bad a law is, you want to ask yourself, what does that mean? What does that mean? So you find that, I didn't find this, but I'll suppose. Let's suppose the felony murder rule reduced robbery by 5%. Okay, how does that make you feel? But what does 5% robbery mean? How important is it to you? But you don't know any of that. All you know is that it's changed robbery. But when I talk in terms of utility, I know that it's something deeper. Right? It's something that you feel, that you can automatically compare to any other thing of value. You can compare it to toothpaste. You can compare it to anything you want to. That's the first thing. Right? That's why I care about utility, and that this is a more direct cost for utility. Here's the second argument. When I look at a criminal law, and I say, what is the effect, say, felony murder on felonies, robberies, I'm just getting the benefit on that one particular issue. One thing I'm not taking a look at, for example, is, well, what are the costs of administration? How much do taxes have to rise? How much do we have to pay the police? How much do we have to pay the judiciary, the judges, the prosecutors, to administer the law? That's not included. But when we look at housing price and wages, that's all included. Because what you're weighing when you move to Illinois because they, let's say, have better or a more drastic felony murder rule, okay, you're saying, well, how much will fine fall? How much is that worth to me? Plus, how much will I have to pay additional property tax to cover the administration cost of the law? And how much is that going to cost me? Right, you're weighing all that in your movement decision. You're seeing the benefits and the costs. Okay? Not only that, but let's suppose that you're a retributivist. You like it. And if somebody dies during a robbery, they should go to, you know, the perpetrator should go to jail. They should be executed. Whatever happens to be, right? If you're a retributivist, then how do we there's some benefit, right, when the law is passed, you're like, right on. I don't mean to trivialize retributives, but you get the idea, right? You might like the law. How do we value that? Well, it's hard to do that with profit behavior because we don't see, you don't do surveys and say, hey, did you say right on after a long time? No, that's hard to do. But guess what? When you move, you're considering those things. And I'm not saying this is only for retributives, but let's suppose you don't like the death penalty. And Illinois basically suspends the death penalty. Well, then you like Illinois. You like the suspension. That's very hard to measure in any approximate behavior studies. But it's very easy to measure in this way. It's captured in your movement decisions. You may move to Illinois. You like it. It's a better jurisdiction on the market. Okay? Remember just a second ago I said the nice thing about looking at utility and the way that you do is you can compare the cost of the value of the law to anything else like toothpaste and things like that. Now that was trivial. But in fact, another benefit of my approach is that you can compare any two laws from any two realms. Right? So you can compare a criminal law to a parental rights law, to a voting rights law, to an anti-discrimination law. Why? Because they're all being measured on the same metric. In my view, they should all be measured on the metric of housing prices and wages, or the sum of those, right? They're all being measured on dollar terms. But if you use, say, some other approach, like approximate effect of profit behavior, you'd say, okay, well, I'm going to look at the voting rights law, I need to look at the effect of voting rights law on participation. Or I need to look at the effect of an anti-discrimination law on black and white wages. Or I need to look at the effect of a criminal law on crime, right? Well, then how do you compare a 5% robbery rate to a 2% increase in participation or to a 3% reduction in the wage differential between blacks and whites? That's really hard to do. Don't have that problem with this approach. Everything's measured on the same metric. I'm not going to worry about data limitations. The basic point, and I don't want to stress it too much, it's a bit technical, but basically since we're all using the same data to evaluate all laws, the empirical project becomes a little bit easier. That's what I mean by the data limitations. But there is one thing I want to highlight, and this is I'm going to try to rekindle the Marxists, deep down Marxists for you. If you don't remember, just remember it's like that first philosophy class or political theory class you took in sophomore year. You've got to grip this, right? So, you know, Marx, we care about distribution, well, not like the way we care about the politically correct way, we care about distribution now, but we worry about property owners, people that are going to hold labor, things like, those are the guys that get everything, right? They're getting all the residual. Well, you know, there's a little bit of truth to that when you think about laws, right? Through the prism that I've given you. And think about it this way. Illinois passes a great law. Suppose I'm right. Housing prices go up. Okay? Who benefits from the rise in housing prices? We know the people that move here don't benefit. They're actually seeing that as a cost, right? Because they've got to pay that higher price. But they got to pay that to somebody. Who are they paying that to? The property owners. What this method tells you is that when you're looking at the consequences of a law, you have to understand that a lot of those benefits accrue to current property owners. Even if those are not your intended beneficiaries, they're benefiting because of the housing price effect. And that can be a meaningful benefit. So even if you want to help, you know, one group in society, if other people in society like that benefit, housing owners are going to benefit automatically. Right? Because everybody's in a bit of housing prices everywhere. Okay, so that's an important distributional effect that you don't see in other studies, and that's kind of highlighted by this method, which is important. Now, here's the great part. I'm going to give you a list of disadvantages. And in fact, you're going to say, hold on a second. I don't know all the fancy logic you're using, but I can count. There are only 5 dots here, and there are like 10 dots here. So this has got to be a bad idea, right? Wrong. I just want to basically give you the whole set of things that could possibly go wrong, and then kind of highlight the ones that I think are serious in red. And the other ones are things that often you can address or that are small. Okay? So let's compare some of them. And I'm going to focus on the red ones first, because those are most important. Okay. Anybody with common sense is going to walk out of this room and say, or already walk out of the room and say, come on. A voting rights act is going to affect housing prices? And if it does, how are you going to capture the housing prices? It's not going to be you or your wages. That's crazy. There's too much noise in the data. Or even if you did find some relationship, I'm not sure I would believe you. Because it seems so tenuous. People would move, or people would change the prices they charge for houses, or the amount of wages they pay because of a law is passed. Do they even know if the law was passed? Right, so these are the things that you're probably thinking about. And my answer to that is, it's an empirical question. Right? In part, it's an empirical question. I have a bunch of statistical tools that I can use to try to prove that it works. I'll give you one example later on, but we can talk a little bit more about the other statistical tools that I use. But basically, it's just a question. If I control for lots of things, and I have fancy tools to do that, and I find that when you pass tort reform in Illinois, that housing prices fell and wages rose, and I can't explain it from anything else, right, because I've done a good empirical job, then I have to come back to you and say, no, there is some evidence that, in fact, tort reform was a bad idea. People moved away from the state. Housing prices fell. They moved away from the state, so there was less labor supply, so wages rose. And that's what I'm going to show you. So in part, it's got to be answered empirically. The other thing I'm going to say is that I think you'll be impressed by the quality of data that we have in housing pricing and wages. Those are two things that are extremely well measured and shouldn't be surprising that people care about wages and housing prices. So we measure very, very well, and depending on the data set you use, we have extremely geographically precise estimates. Okay? I'll give you another problem. Illegitimate preferences. This is a problem to which I have no answer, and all I can do is issue a caution. When I propose this method, I'm proposing as a method to evaluate whether law is empirically good or bad. That's not the same thing as saying, oh, if after a law is passed, housing prices rise or wages fall, you should definitely enact the law. That's not what I'm saying. That's the step for you to take once you see the results that I might show you. Okay? Why is that? Well, for one thing, I don't ask why people like the law. I'll accept any reason for why people like the law. Right? So if you don't like retributivist emotions, and then I find that the death penalty raises housing prices and lowers wages, it's a good thing, you might say, I don't want to hear it. I don't want to hear it because I don't give any value to retributivist emotions or values. And you're picking all that up, right? And I can give you more nefarious examples. Let's suppose that you have a law that cuts back voting rights that's motivated by racial animosity. My approach, this could be highly damning, but I want to be honest about this. My approach won't say that I'm going to rule out that this law is a good thing. Because even racist emotions can change housing prices. Okay? Yet we may not want to count that. So when we evaluate the law using this method, we have to be very clear. If we think that illegitimate preferences are driving a lot of the conclusions that we think are going on, I mean, we can't just say there's one person that's racist and say that's a qualified thing, but if we think it's meaningful, then we really have to be careful about converting the finding, empirical finding that I may have with respect to the law, to a normative conclusion that one should adopt the law. Okay, so I'll be very honest about the legitimate preferences. I don't discriminate against those, sadly, although I think that in many cases we should. The other problem is very important, and this is more of a kind of, this is a little bit more fun to think about, less blunt, I think. So let me show you what's going on here. Depending on how scarce the law is, you're going to get a different price for the law, just like you would with any other good. Because I'm claiming a law is just like a good. Right? The more you supply of it, the price falls. Right? We learned this from basic economics. Right? Greater supply reduces price. Right? Everybody get that? Now I know everybody's saying, no, wait a second, supply curve is upward sloping. That's different. I'm talking about the equilibrium. As supply moves out, prices fall. Right? If I double the supply in a market, the price will fall. Same thing with the law. So imagine a situation where, talk about a law. Let's pick a law. Let's say, what's a recent law that I like? So let's say it's reporting, here's a good one. So there's I do health law. And in health law, there's this recent proposal that the CDC has to require HPV vaccines for women between, I think, the ages of 11 and 20 or something like that. And there's a big debate about whether or not those vaccinations should be made mandatory, HPV vaccinations, right? It's supposed to prevent certain lesions that can cause cancerous growth in women, okay? Cause cervical cancer. So I'm going to say the following. Let's suppose there could be either 50 states or 0 states that adopt this law, okay? And let's suppose it's a good law, but not everybody thinks it's a good law, okay? Let's suppose that by population about half people think it's a good law and half people think it's a bad law. Right? Then what happens? When one state passes the law, people can move to it, right? And this is going to be, on this axis, we're going to draw dollars. And actually, this is fine. We can go into the negative region as well. Okay? So can you guys can't see this, can you? Just imagine. It's a beautiful graph, really articulate. I can draw it again over there if you'd like. But just imagine prices falling, because that's basically what I'm going to point out here. So if the first state passes the law, a lot of people move to it, so housing prices rise. This is just going to be housing prices in this context, okay? Housing prices are pretty high. People are rushing to move to a state where, good, they have a mandatory vaccine that's going to prevent cervical cancer in women and reduce the incidence. Well, a second state passes the law. Oh, yeah, there's some people, but a lot of people bought the houses in this state. There are a few people that will buy the houses in this state. As you supply more and more, just like you might expect, the value of the law falls, okay? In fact, if you adopt the mandatory vaccination law, it's not only in all the states that people want it, but in states where people don't want it, all of a sudden house prices are going to fall. Right? People don't like it. Why? Because they're going to bid up prices in the states that don't have the law. Okay? And so this is what your price is going to look like as you supply more and more and more. Just like you would when you're trying to measure the value of a particular good. As you increase supply and you just look at the market price, it's going to fall. Same thing happens with the law. Well, why do you have to know that? Well, you have to know that because you can't just say, oh, I'm just going to look at one state, let's say this is 5 states. I'm going to look at 5 states have the law. This is the price that I estimate. That's the value of the law. No, it's the value of the law given the supply that you've given, just like with any other good. And you have to take that into account when you compare two different goods, right? That means that it might not be fair to compare a law that was just passed, highly demanded law that was just passed in one state versus another highly demanded law that was passed in 5 states. You have to take into account how many states we've passed. But we do these sort of comparisons anytime we compare two different goods with two different levels of supply. So that shouldn't be something that really concerns us. It's just something that we should be aware of. So scarcity value laws ostensibly looks like a concern, but it's nothing new to economists. Okay, then we can look at some of the other things. I want to pay attention to time. Okay. So here's another one. What if people don't get it, don't understand how the law works? Well, they don't understand what the real effects of the law are, right? Let's suppose that we find out the death penalty does nothing to reduce murders, okay? And empirical studies establish that, right? No reduction in murders, and it's god-awfully expensive to run capital trials. Let's suppose. I don't want to bobble over that, but let's just assume that's the case. You might imagine that not everybody has figured that out by looking at the fancy studies. A lot of you might still think the death penalty deters crime, and it's not that expensive to administer. What am I picking up? I'm picking up the latter sentiment, not the prior fact. Okay? I'm looking at what people think is going on, not what really is going on. Right? If you think a law is good, even though in reality it's massively increasing crime rates or polluting the environment or whatnot, If you think the law is good, it'll still show up as a higher average price or a lower wage. And that's what I'm going to measure. So you have to ask yourself a deep philosophical question. What do you care about? Do you care about objective outcomes? Or do you care about subjective outcomes? Do you care about what people think? And I'm going to make the argument that I actually care about what people think. Right? So take that Coke. If you think it's really much better than it really is for you, that is to say, if you think it's going to give you 5 hours worth of, you know, caffeine, rush, adrenaline, you're going to do really great, well, that's what I care about. Not what it actually is doing for you, because that's the happiness that's causing it. It's a deeper thing. I care about what you feel. I know I said I don't care. You get it? But in this way, I do. So, there we go. I care, and I think a good argument made, that I care about what you think about your consumption, what you think about the law, and how happy it makes you feel, not just objective things that never enter your conscience. Right? If you're not one of those people, if you think, no, it's all the objective that matters and there's nothing else, well, this is not the right method for you. You got to go back to looking at the effect on foxes' behavior. Although even there, you can be a little bit concerned, right? Because foxes' behavior is motivated by how people change their behavior based on their beliefs. I just have to surrender completely to beliefs. They only surrender partially to those beliefs, so those subjective beliefs. Okay? Now, here are a few other small problems that I can address. I'd like to look at weaknesses that I can quickly flip, right, to make me look good. So one is that, well, when I look at the effect of crime on of a criminal law on crime, what am I getting? Well, I'm getting how that criminal law is working. Right? If it's good, is it good because it lowered homicides, or it reduced murders, or something like that? Okay? My method doesn't tell you that. It just tells you at the end of the day, people like it. How are we supposed to figure out how the law works? Right? So that's a big difference between the proximate behavior method and my method. My method just gives you a final profit. Right? It's just like, there's a profit statement at the bottom. I don't tell you how the profits were earned or lost. I just tell you what they are at the end of the day when you pass the law. Now, that's not a hurdle that we can't overcome, because we can do both methods together. Or conversely, let's suppose you're running an empirical analysis and you're trying to figure out, okay, what is the effect of passing a felony murder law on housing prices and wages? Well, if I just control for the effect that the law has on felony rates or gun homicides, right, I'm basically saying, well, what is the effect on housing prices controlling for these things outside of those channels? In this manner, I can back out other things about how the law is working. So if you think the gun law the felony murder law works in two ways. There's a positive benefit because it reduces crime, and there's a negative cost. There's a cost that's bad for us, and that's the cost of administration. If I run my analysis and I control for the crime, then I'm basically going to back out for you with the administrative cost of the law. So in that sense, I am the mirror image, the method is the mirror image of the proximate effect on behavior method. Right, that identifies some behaviors. I tell you what the effect of everything else is. Okay, what else? Oh yeah, here's an important one, because we sometimes care about this. That was a joke. It's a few more laughs, it's good. Okay, now it's a pop. So, guess what? Not only does this method have a problem that it weighs illegitimate preferences, just like legitimate preferences, but it weighs the preferences of rich people over poor people. And the reason is because it relies on market transactions. And any market transaction weighs rich people over poor people. Right? Income, people with lots of income can move prices. People without income, without lots of income can't move prices. In the extreme, they can move prices because they can't enter the market. Right? I can tell you more detail about this later, but I think you can buy that. Now, if that's the case, then basically what I'm saying is the valuations that I'm coming up with are biased towards the preferences of wealthy people. And we may not like that. So is that a reason to not do this method? It isn't. And here's the simple reason why. Most of the data sets, actually all the data sets that I use, not only have housing prices and wages, but for everybody that's responded that gives you the housing price or their wage, we also have their income, their wealth. So all we have to do is account for that in our statistical analysis. And I basically, just put it in a very crude way, I basically downweight or discount people's valuations implicit in their housing prices and wages by their wage. So if you're a rich, not their wage, but their income or their wealth. So if you're a really high income person, say you earn twice as much as me, I'll weight your preference half as much when I calculate the valuations. And so that's a really simple way to get back to a situation where we're weighing everybody equally. Now, if you like some other sort of distribution, you want to weight the people with, that are particularly poor with you, give them even more weight, you can do that too. You can choose the distribution you want, and you can play, you can use the statistics to get the proper valuation. Now, it's quite possible that'll change your valuation, but you have to then understand that it's your distributional preferences that are doing the work. Okay? And we can use as a baseline just weighting everybody so that irrespective of income, their preferences are weighted the same. That's possible. Okay, so let me stop there and give you just one example. So this is from a paper that I wrote, and I just pulled out some numbers from Table 9 because they're really easy to understand. What I looked at is two things. So one was punitive damages cap, which is a form of tort reform, cap on punitive damages that can be given in tort suits. And another one was a law that required health insurance companies to cover diabetes treatments. So it's diabetes coverage mandates. And I said, okay, what is the effect of these things on, for example, monthly rent, hourly wage? Right? Why am I looking at monthly rent? Well, that's my measure of housing prices. Now, I know that's not ownership, that's leasing, but if you buy that there's a relatively efficient transaction between the two, those guys should be correlated. They should be in equilibrium. So it's fine to look at rent. And one of the advantages of looking at rentable prices is rent values are much more accurate. Right? Just think about it this way. You get a survey and somebody says to you, how much is your house worth? You have to think a little bit harder because it's been years since you bought it. But if I ask you how much is your rent, that's easy because you paid it at least within 30 days. Right? So in that sense, that's why I use the monthly rent data. And then hourly wage is easy. It's generally all very very accurate, or relatively accurate when it comes to economic data. So what does this table tell you? Well, this table tells you that if you pass a punitive damage cap, monthly rents fall by roughly 18 or 19 bucks. Okay? And hourly wages rise by about 5 cents. What if you do a diabetes coverage mandate? Well, you get the opposite effect, kinda. You get an increase in housing in the average monthly rent of $14.51, and your wages fall on average. And I'm controlling for lots of things here and doing a lot of statistical gymnastics to control for lots of other things. But wages fall by roughly 14 cents per hour. Right? Not large by itself. But you might say, okay, now I need to figure out what the cost and benefit. I need to aggregate this up so this is meaningful to you. So we can imagine, okay, let's look at from the perspective of a full-time worker. Okay, for a full-time worker, we want to take the monthly rent, and this is per month. We want to say they're going to pay a cost of 18 bucks, but the hourly wage, I want to think about how many hours they're going to work in a month and multiply that out, right, and see what the total cost is. Now, when I do that and I sum them together, I get a number that looks like 20 bucks per month. For a full-time worker, punitive damage caps is a loss of welfare of 20 bucks. So this concludes that it's a net loss to residents of states that have it, okay, of 20 bucks. Diabetes mandates has the opposite effect, 20 bucks in the positive direction, right? I've taken this as given, and then I multiplied this out by the number of hours that you work in a month, okay? But guess what? What if I'm a part-time worker? If I'm a part-time worker, I'm bearing different types of costs, right? Because I'm not bearing the wage cost as much. So things are going to change. So the value to the part-time worker is different, right? And it can actually change what's going on. And the value here is just going to be less. So what does that tell us? Well, you don't have to go through a lot of gymnastics to calculate these numbers, but you have to understand that a law, because of these dynamics, can be worth different amounts to different people, depending on how exposed they are to labor market costs and how exposed they are to the housing market. So part-time workers and full-time workers may get a different perspective on this. Okay? So let me stop there. That gives you some sense that this approach is practical. Oh, by the way, I didn't put up, and I can show you in the paper, is that these variables are drawn from papers that look at the proximate effect of these laws. So punitive damage caps looks at things like, okay, if you do punitive damage caps, they were looking at it from the perspective of medical malpractice, do doctors stay in the state? There's another study that was looking at what is the effect on total number of deaths in the state from tort accidents. Things like that, or insurance rates. And the diabetes coverage mandate looks at things like coverage. Other studies look at just at coverage, or what is the effect on total health expenditures, things like that. I'm looking at overall welfare, all things including the direct value of the diabetes coverage mandate. Okay? So let me stop there. I've given you an example. We've talked about the costs and benefits. I'm sure you have questions and doubts. Yes.
What if the housing crisis in the state of Illinois go up, for example, because Illinois passes a zoning law zoning out all low-income housing. There's a mass migration of poor people to Indiana and other neighboring states. Would you call this a valuable law to Illinois?
No, and that's a great question. So that's a very insightful question. And this is why I put this asterisk in here. Aggregate is necessary. Let me tell you what I mean by this. When you think about the value of a law, you don't want to look at the value per person. If you look at it per person, which is what that table that I put up, look at it per person. That works if you're holding the housing stock constant. But if the housing stock can change, what you're really interested in, right, just like I said with the lake, you're interested in all the area under the curve. But as the number of housing units rises, you need to look at the value of all the housing units, including the new ones. So in some sense, you need to kind of take the value of each house in the entire state. As the number of houses changes and increases or decreases, you need to look at the value. So now how do we apply it to zoning? And let's even keep it simpler than zoning, although zoning is just a mechanism to do this. What is zoning trying to do? Zoning is trying to do, in some cases, right, in the nefarious cases, it's just trying to reduce housing stock. And we know that if you decrease supply, if you decrease supply, price will rise. But we also know that if you decrease supply, rise, individual housing price will rise. If you look at the total value of housing stock, it falls. There's less quantity, and there's higher price, but the less quantity outweighs the higher price. And so as long as if you worry about that sort of effect going on, it's very important to aggregate across all the houses. So when I get my valuation here, right, so even if I go to table 9, I call it table 9 because that was what it was in the paper. If you're worried about that, what I would say is don't stop with your $20 number, right? Multiply that by the number of workers or the amount of housing stock. That's how you can do that even before you add them together. You multiply this by the housing stock, you multiply this by the number of workers. Aggregate that together, then you add them up, and then you get your result. That's how you do it. That's a great question. Back there.
Could you please explain why actual movement is necessary? It seems to me that...
Why
no actual movement is necessary?
Yeah.
Because it seems like moving somewhere would be pretty expensive. And I want to know what you need to do to make the cost of moving irrelevant.
Right. So I'm going to give you two answers. The first reason why no actual movement is necessary is because what happens if you're a homeowner in Illinois after Illinois passed a good law that you know people in Indiana are going to want to move to? Even before they move, you're going to sit there and you're going to say, well, I can estimate what they think the law is worth, and I'm going to raise my wage, the price of my house, purchased by anybody, so that I can capture that gain. Even if somebody else in Illinois is going to buy it, because I want them to capture the gain for when the guy from Indiana moves in. So what you do is you change your reservation price, right? The minimum price that you will accept for the house once a good law is passed. Okay, that's the first answer. The second answer is, okay, come on. There's two elements to this. One is that you're probably raising skeptics. Do people even know about the law? But let's put that aside. The other question is, the one that you ask is, what about moving costs? How do we address the moving costs? Right? Well, this is the way to think about this. And this is the way I think probably think about a lot of situations where you think there are transaction costs engaging with purchase or market transactions. You have to ask yourself, are there a lot of people out there that are already ready to move and that are choosing between places? So among those people, we don't have to worry about the transaction costs. There's certainly not people for which the law is worth more than the transaction cost, although you may be skeptical that any law is worth more than the cost of moving, right? $3,000? What law is worth $3,000? Amortized over a lifetime, it might be $3,000. But for people where it's a much closer call, you have to ask yourself, well, are there a category of people that are already moving, and for them, they're not weighing the marginal cost of moving, the moving cost, they're not doing that anyway, they're just choosing between states. And I would argue that that's probably true. There's some one class, not the only class, that I can think of for which this is true. And you were in very, very recently. College grads. There's a high rate of mobility among college grads. They're going to move somewhere. They don't just stay in whatever state they went to college, although there's a high rate of that, but not all of them do that. And they already know. They're just choosing between states. Now, it's true they're measuring a lot of other things. Where do I have jobs? Where is my partner, girlfriend, boyfriend moving to? What sports teams do I like? These are important considerations. But if you're choosing among them, you just have to find a few people, and by a few I mean a few thousand people, that are saying, okay, it's tough, a choice between two different places. And then at that point, a law can make a difference. So large number of people in this. Now, it's very hard to get the exact number. But I'll tell you this, 10% of people move every year. 10% of people move every year. Now that's in-state and out-of-state. So we need to separate in-state from out-of-state. But even if you took 1/50 of that, right? You think about the number of people in the United States. 300 million, 10%, right? 30 million, take 1/50 of that. You're talking nearly a million people, 800,000 people moving each year. We only have to have to deal with the 50 states, and the law issue is only mattering for certain states and certain areas. So I think that there might be enough movement to actually generate the sorts of numbers that we're getting and the precision with which we're estimating enough. So that's my kind of my answer.
I wasn't clear from your discussion about the mechanisms of causation when you were talking about using other data to back out certain factors.
Yeah.
Does that mean that you could distinguish whether the effect of the law or the value that people ascribe to the law comes from its actual operation versus its signaling value?
Here's what you can do. You might conflate things. So let's use a criminal law. Okay, let's use the death penalty. And let's suppose that there's some change in the death penalty. Actually, we don't have to assume this at all. So what are the effects of the death penalty? There are three things that I think of saying at once. One is whether you're not changing murder rates. The second one is the administration costs. And the third one is symbolic meaning. Right? And some people like it, some people don't. I'm just going to think about the average, whether people like it or not. Now, I can gather data on murder rates. So if I run an analysis that says, what is the effect of the death penalty on housing prices and wages, controlling for mortality rates, death rates, sorry, murder rates, then I'm basically going to be identifying the effect of the last two things. What are they? Administration, cost of administration, and signaling. Now, if I could also identify somewhere else the cost of capital trials, or I could figure out how much I control for how much money is being spent on prisons and on police and on judiciaries, then I can also back out the symbolic effects. Right? But you have to work backwards. Just controlling for, you've got to figure out what plausibly might be the three mechanisms. You control one, you conflate the other two, you control two, you've identified the last one. But you can back out, yes, the symbolic value in this matter.
Well, because the reason I'm asking is because even especially with the death penalty, I was wondering if you might not see this effect at other times besides just when the law is passed. Like, for example, when there is an execution,
mm-hmm.
and it reminds people that such and such a state is a death penalty state. And
yeah.
So maybe if someone who's making a decision about a move in that time, who really thinks the death penalty is terrific, you might see the effects, even though the law wasn't just passed, but people are reminded of it, and so to the extent that signaling value is important,
the only thing that's exactly right. In fact, in a early version of this paper, I did some analysis of death penalty data, and I won't put very much credence on it because it's pretty primitive. But I found, for example, each execution is worth 75 cents. Okay, now that seems kind of trivial to you, but note that it was kind of very early on in the paper, but it was based upon each execution. It wasn't the law.
Mm-hmm.
It was the execution actually triggering 75% increase in housing prices plus the decrease in wage. So 75% gain. 75 cents. Not percent. Cents. Very clear. Huge difference between that. Okay. But, now, aside from I have concerns about the quality of data in the death penalty, but even when I'm looking at that, do I want that to jump? Well, that's purely symbolic, because that's all that's going on whenever there's an execution. And my answer to that is I'm not clear about that, because it could be the execution not only reminding the residents of the state, oh, we have a death penalty, so go retribute this. It is also saying to perhaps potential people that are going to commit crime, I just want to remind you there's a death penalty, and we do actually follow through or execute. So in that sense, you're getting both the deterrence and you're getting the symbolic. So it wouldn't just say that that's uniquely identical. Yeah.
How do you control for or not?
How do you control for just one law? Well, so there's a standard way that economists use when they're looking at one change they want to hold everything else constant. Depending on how much data they have, they can get even more intricate with it. So here's the standard approach. Let's suppose we're looking at, I don't want to keep on focusing on death penalty, but I will for one more question. So death penalty, either executions or when a death penalty law is passed, or you have a moratorium, one or the other. Now, there are a lot of other things going on, but you might imagine that unless there's something else going on that's correlated with this, I can control for all other things that are going on through two mechanisms. One is, and also combinations make. One is to include a variable that just indicates that ticks off years. So there's one variable that just captures all activities in 1977, another one for 1978, so on and so forth. I can also do that by state or by jurisdiction or by zip code. So for each zip code, I'm controlling for anything else that's staying constant during that time, right, over the entire range of the study. And I can do combinations of these, so I can have a time trend that's specific to a state. Now, what are these things doing? Well, they're just saying, look, there could be background noise going on and changes going on, and as long as they're not directly correlated with the law that I'm concerned about, then these trends are going to pick those things up, because they're more closely related to a trend or an indicator variable for the state than anything else. The thing that you have to be worried about is the spurious correlation. It shows that not only at the time that you pass the death penalty law, you also make 10 other reforms in your criminal law. You have to measure those. Because if those are the things that are doing the work, but you're not measuring them, they're not going to be picked up by anything, because they're going to be more closely correlated with, and thus attributed through in the statistical method, attributed to the death penalty than anything else. So you have to be precise, but you do have some leeway. The leeway generally deals with laws that you think are unrelated, but when you talk about criminal law, you should try to control for a range of criminal law. So when I do this, I do two things. One is I do a lot of laws in that same area and tabulate them all together. And the second thing that I do is I check for certain types of, we call them falsification tests. So, for example, I did this with the death penalty, and it made me more confident, but not confident enough. I checked to see if there was a differential effect of the death penalty, depending on where you live. So I would imagine, for example, that people living inside the city would think differently about a death penalty than people living outside the city. Why? Different crime rates inside the city versus outside the city. There might be also differences in terms of how, what your views, symbolic views of the law, right? You might be, imagine people in the suburbs favor it more. And in fact, you find something like that. You actually find that if you just look at inner cities and you try to figure out if the death penalty is good, it is not good, according to this measure. It's actually a net decrease in housing prices plus an increase in wage. So it's a net loss. And in suburbs, it's reported as a gain. The net, not surprisingly because suburbs have greater wealth, is you end up with a 75% gain. 75 cents. Kill myself. No, it's not gonna, people are gonna think I'm crazy. 75 cents. Write that down. 75 cent gain, but it's because I'm averaging across the two where I think the suburbs are getting a little bit more weight, and that's why you're seeing the numbers change. So these are the ways that I check for this. And again, it's a problem with lots of other studies. I just have to be careful about it, because I want to say everything is evaluated on the same metric. Yes.
This reminds me of one of those plots my friends and I had over beer, which was to support Marion Barry for mayor of D.C. in order to compete at the housing prices in Hawaii, and then in 8 years he'd be on prices to rise.
Well, yeah.
So, I mean, when I look at this, I think
yeah, but you know, there would be a loss in the interim, right? People would be losing because they want their housing prices to fall.
Right.
You may not have won the cost.
We would be renters going to owners. We would be renters becoming owners. So what this makes me wonder is, if you, to what extent can a state legislature that wants to support wealthy property owners, people who get voted on a lot of property donations, just lose the point of by passing whatever laws that are statistically likely to lead to an increase in housing prices? And whether if you're supporting laws simply for that basis, this is actually a sustainable way to raise housing prices for political reasons, or whether the fact that you're just
So you know something? You have intuited a very important hypothesis in political economics. So there's this guy named William Michel, a lot of people who confuse with our Bill Michel, who's at Dartmouth, who has this book called The Homeowner Hypothesis, which is related to what I'm saying, and here's what he says that's related. He says he studies local politics. And he's an economist who studies local politics, and he analyzes why municipalities adopt the policies. His hypothesis is, look, if I look at the voter roll, and I see the people that are much more likely to vote than anybody else are people that adopt. Renters don't vote, property owners don't. And the property owners, when they vote, they're voting with an eye to their primary asset. Their primary asset, at least locally, is their house. And so his hypothesis is that, in fact, exactly what you say is going on, and it's been going on for a long period of time. That very locally, politicians, you vote for your local mayor, your local alderman, you vote on the basis of whether or not they're going to adopt policies that are increasing property value, because that's the main return to you. He doesn't think the symbolic stuff matters at all. This is local politics. You're not talking about abortion politics, you're talking about just zoning and things like that. So he thinks that happens. He thinks it's happened for a long period of time. He doesn't think it happens at any level outside the locale, because at that point, there are other interests that come into play. and the policies that the tools that the, you know, say that the person at the county or the person at the state level have are just much different. Right? There's much more tenuous connection between you and that person. And in fact, their policies on you is unclear because it could affect somebody else, right? You could be raising housing prices in another district. But I see an argument that actually occurs. Now, do I think it's a conspiracy? No, he thinks that that's actually what, right? That's what they want. This is democracy in action.
Yeah. I'm wondering why your analysis would be better than just doing a telephone poll and asking people if you like this law or not. Is it that your method is more accurate or that it measures something different?
Yes, it measures this. Right. Now you might say, well, why can't we call up and say how much are you willing to pay for a moratorium on the death penalty? The problem with that is that people can say whatever they want. They have nothing at stake. But when they buy a house, they actually put money at stake, right? They gave up cash. They bet on their answer in the survey. They don't do that in an ordinary survey. So now my response to you is no different than any response that any economist gives to why don't we do surveys instead of looking at market prices for anything? This is the reason. It's because people, they don't buy the survey. People don't have an incentive to give the right answer on the survey. So I think that's the short answer.
I guess you mentioned a little bit about kind of different tastes or variety of preferences that people have. So we worry about racist preferences, for example. But if you were comparing laws in two different states, say Illinois lives in this moratorium on the death penalty and reinstates it, in California at the same time places a moratorium on the death penalty, do we think that people with different political preferences potentially would value laws differently, so that if you're comparing California property values, that their property values may rise when they're adopting the exact opposite laws? Illinois and Illinois' property values.
Well,
like the red state, blue state.
In theory, it could happen. Although I would use Illinois. That's great. It's possible, but you have to. What is going on there? Is the transaction cost, right? So you'd have to make it through, in terms of theoretical possibility of cost. And what I'd be arguing is, okay, let's suppose the transaction cost is such that you only move one single. You can't move two singles. Just for cost, or at least the value of the law is such that it's just worth a one single, but not a two single, and there's dramatic difference in prices for the one single. Then it's possible that Montana is drawing from border states for it, which are all red states, and so when it passes a law that increases the death penalty, it's getting an increase in housing price, and California is surrounded by blue states, and the people that are moving to it are all blue state people, so in fact housing prices rise also when you choose a blue state, when you reduce the death penalty, or you eliminate the death penalty. That's theoretically possible. I don't know how practical it is. One reason I think it's problematic is that you don't find a strong nonlinearity in moving costs. There's just a gas that you can't go across the state, but the fixed costs are below the unknown. So that's one reason I would think it's possible. The second answer that I give you is, if you really saw that, like if I saw that in the data, I would worry about what people worry about. And the way that I would answer that is I'd say, okay, when I compare the value of a law, right, what I'm really implicitly doing is I'm saying, okay, I have, say, we're talking about Montana, I'm looking at the trend, and let's suppose this is the time in which you pass the law that increases executions, right? I'm looking at the trend, and I'm looking to see if price rises, okay? But I know that there's a general trend in housing prices anyway, right? We know that housing prices move a lot of different reasons. So I look at all other states, right, and I look at their trend, what's happening, and even if they're increasing the limit, I'm looking at the difference between this. And so I'm saying, yes, it looks like it increased this much, but it's only about half of it was really unique to Montana. And it's only half of it I'm going to attribute to the death penalty in Montana. Okay? But now compare it to all other states. Once you make your argument where I see this kind of perverse effect going on, I will say, well, maybe I shouldn't compare it to all other states. Maybe what I need to compare it to is border states. By border, I mean bordering on Montana. Right? Border states. And in this scenario, it might be that that effect goes away. Right? That's one thing that I would look at. Then I would say, okay, you know, the reason why this is the proper comparison, because I'm looking at the feasible alternatives for these guys rather than implausible alternatives. Somebody's not going to move from Florida to Montana. That's how I control the time. And if the effect still persists, then you're going to have to conclude that the transaction, the moving costs are serious, right? Or I have to say that, yeah, there's just different preferences in different regions. I've identified Montana or thereabouts. People like the death penalty and people that happen to be located in California, they're about to. But I do that extra step to make sure. That's what this is.
It seems like when we value the law, it also should incorporate whether or not we think the law is enforced in a particular area. So I'm wondering, how do you count enforcement into your...
It's all in. That includes enforcement or non-enforcement. So when I look at the value of the law, actually, let me be precise about this. I potentially include enforcement or non-enforcement. What I really include is people's beliefs about enforcement or non-enforcement. So let's suppose you pass a death penalty law that authorizes death penalties, but in fact no executions are taking place, right, for whatever reason. But if people think executions are taking place, you might still see a positive symbolic benefit of the law among those who produce this. Right? They'll think the law is working, even though it's not. Now, if you think that people have an accurate assessment of an actual enforcement rates, then what happens is you're actually picking up in the housing price the actual enforcement.
But what if you have variation within that population? Say, like Chicago, criminal law should be the same everywhere, but South Side versus the North Side, like how do you account for that?
So the nice thing about the data that I have, in the public version of the data, you can't do this. You can only do city-level analysis. But in the private version of the data, so there's certain centers that you can go to study the private version of the data. Or if you, has anybody engaged in a market transaction with house? Has anybody with an MLS listing? Have you heard of an MLS listing? Okay. So this is a private kind of collaboration among realtors to have uniform prices for houses. Among those guys, you have these data that are key to block. Right? It's exact locations, you know where they are. So you could actually run this sort of analysis separately for, you know, Hyde Park, Woodlawn, Kenwood. You could do it separately. You could figure out where the house is, and then do it separately for Old Town, Gold Coast, you name it, right? And then figure out what the separate effects are in each place. One of the nice things about that, and an advantage that I didn't point out, is you can figure out the distributional effects of the law. By geography, you could say, oh, the north side benefited only in this region, so south side lost in these regions.
I think
we're out of time?
Yeah, one short one.
One short. Short?
So, yeah.
Okay.
But what do you do about laws which have an effect that's below the transaction cost of moving, but might add up a lot over time, thinking like void drawout bans and such? When those sort of quality of life things, you know, stack up, there'll be a jump if you won't be able to tell what it wants.
Yeah, so in practice, a limitation is if the transaction cost is too high, you're not going to get anything. Aggregating it over time doesn't change things because the transaction costs hit each period. Now, it's less likely to hit if you think that you're talking about moving and staying there for a while. So, for example, if the foie gras ban, let's say, cost $3,000 for me to move, but the foie gras ban was worth $100 to me, then as long as I was staying 30 years, it would still be worth it for me to move. So if you're looking at actual, not renters, but owners, and you think owners are long-term enough, then it would still be picked up. So basically what that does is that amortizes the transaction cost. And by the way, this is a response to one of the questions we had earlier. The transaction cost is actually amortized over the number of years over which you think you're going to enjoy the law. That is to say, how long you're going to be in that state. So that lowers the transaction cost. But again, if that's still too high, right, if you don't think people are going to stay for 30 years, and it's only worth $100, then you're not going to see it. So transaction costs will, in some sense, cause you to lose some information. But, you know, to me, that's like noise and data. That can happen with any kind of method, even the proximate cause method, right? If the changes in crime rates are sufficiently small, I'm not going to see it. It's going to be swamped by noise. But yeah, that's got to be a weakness. All right, I'm happy to take a few more questions.
Thank you. That might be a question.